Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Dakota Digest. I'm Nate Weck, and thanks for joining me. Here's the top news and programming from South Dakota Public Broadcasting for the week ending January 8th. The jury in a Pennington County child abuse case has failed to reach a unanimous verdict. On Friday evening, after determining that the jury was hung, Seventh Circuit Judge Wally Eklund declared a mistrial. It is now up to the state's attorney to decide whether to go through another trial. If tried again, Patrick Whiteface will face only one charge. Before the jury went into deliberation, Judge Eklund entered a judgment of acquittal on count two. SDPB's Victoria Wicks reports.
Patrick Whiteface was accused of injuring his infant daughter on two occasions. On March 24, 2011, Whiteface took the baby to the emergency room where x-rays revealed that the child's left femur was broken. Whiteface told doctors and investigators that he heard a pop while lifting the child up by her legs to change her diaper. 4 days after that trip to the hospital, the baby was again in medical crisis. She was gray and unresponsive and airlifted to Colorado, where it was discovered she had critical brain damage. The state alleged at trial that Whiteface had obstructed the baby's air supply, but a defense expert said the child appeared to have suffered from a sustained seizure that depleted her glucose and oxygen. That second charge is the one Judge Eklund dismissed. The defense made a motion to acquit the defendant on both charges based on inadequate evidence of a crime, and Eklund granted the motion on count two. That left the jury to decide count one regarding the broken leg. In closing arguments, Deputy State's Attorney Josh Hendrickson told jurors that an infant's leg does not break from a diaper change. He said Whiteface clearly applied excessive force, and that is the definition of child abuse. And he reminded jurors that the state's medical witnesses, the doctors who examined the infant, did not find the break to be accidental. Public defender Tom Diggins relied on testimony from Dr. Christopher Sullivan, an orthopedic surgeon from Chicago. Sullivan said an infant's femur is slightly smaller than a pencil, and the baby's break occurred at the narrowest part of the bone. He said baby's bones are more fragile before a child starts to walk, and a small amount of rotation can break a bone, such as when twisting the child into a onesie. Patrick Whiteface remains free on bond. Parties will discuss what happens next at a status hearing yet to be set.
A very special Christmas gift was given to the historic Homestake Opera House. Fundraising efforts spanning 2 years have secured the purchase of a Yamaha CX Series 7-foot grand piano that was installed this week. Executive Director Sarah Carlson explained the nuances of purchasing the instrument when she joined Dakota Midday this week to talk about it. Have a listen.
Executive Director Sarah Carlson joins us to discuss the long-awaited, much-anticipated grand piano. Sarah, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's just start out with, where is it at in the process of coming to you? Is it there?
Has it been? It's not here yet. It's in Rapid City. Tomorrow, Friday at 12:30, it will be brought into the theater, and the board of directors and our donors and volunteers are really excited to see that happen.
So let's go back a little bit then to talk about the donation and the kickoff of that. Take us back in history and put it in perspective.
Sure. We've had a great instrument, a baby grand, on stage since about 2005. It was donated. Several people are involved at that time, and we used the heck out of that piano. And all the way up through 2008, with the first community theater in 25 years since a historic theater fire in 1984. And in 2008, we had Fiddler on the Roof, and that brought in about 80 community members for this community theater. And that was kind of a re-energizing time for the Opera House. And that also kicked off, you know, the next 6 years of community theater programming, of doing these shows on our own. And it also included having piano performers, piano concerts. In 2013, unfortunately, during a beautiful Gershwin concert encore, the entire pedal system came off the bottom of the piano, and it was quite an end to a concert, for one, but it also set us on, we embarked on a journey to raise money in parallel with everything else we're raising money for, in the hopes of bringing a true professional concert piano back to the stage.
So, who's participating in that? Who are your donors?
Sure. It was kicked off by the Black Hills Area Community Foundation Quality of Life Initiative. And as we all know, music is part of the quality of our lives. And they kicked that off with a $2,500 donation. And then from there, donors got involved with the project, understanding the need for such a space to have such an instrument. And Matt Batchelder of Batchelder's Plumber Piano in Rapid City also got involved, as did other piano sellers in the area as planners for us, cohorts, advisors. And we came upon the idea that we would like to have a Yamaha for many different reasons. And then just recently, we had a matching donor who encouraged us. You know, when you have those matching dollars, it encourages others to give. And we made our goal this year, and we were able to purchase that instrument on Christmas. Hmm. And the family of Don Perdue, he is from Rapid City and was inspired in the theater last year in 2014 during the Black Hills Cowboy Christmas concert, which is a popular event,
right,
and saw the need for that instrument.
And so why a Yamaha, and where is it coming from?
It's coming from California, and we chose a Yamaha just based on all of the referrals that we had from climate change. And I'm no piano expert by any stretch of imagination, but it was something that was told. The Yamaha Grand Piano is extraordinary. They're reliable. They're durable. We had seven interviews or so with pianists who would be playing the instrument, who have played several different types and brands of pianos. And this series is a new series, a CX series, for its recent improvements in resonance, expressive control. We think that this is something that, you know, we could go bigger. Mm-hmm. We could do grander, I'm sure, but we want something that's reliable and appropriate for our stage.
So tell me about your stage, and where is it going to sit inside there?
Sure. Our stage, 1914 stage, it will be very gently used, I should say stored in a chamber box, which is also new to me. It is like a piano garage, and it is lockable and climate controlled, and it will live off stage, away from anything that might have any damage to it, of course. And we'll roll it out on a piano dolly that we just purchased, exciting, for all kinds of different reasons. We've got several concerts planned, and just off stage we have an area for the volunteers and the wandering tourists not to enter. So
right.
this will be truly our baby conservatory piano.
And how long do you expect it to last? How long do you expect it to live in the Opera House?
That's a question for those who know how long you can have a piano. The mm-hmm. one we had, it far extended past, I'm sure, its life. This one we call our next century mm-hmm. grand piano because we truly are entering our next century. And, you know, all of these other organizations, there's another one in Rapid City, the School of Mines and Technology, just purchased the exact same instrument for their music department. And so we know it's a really good choice, and we know it's going to have a long, long life here.
I have a piano that's almost 100 years old in my house, so I totally understand this concept of it's not just, you don't just go out and buy it. They're more complicated than you think. When you got into this, were you surprised at all the nuances of what this instrument is?
You're right, and I've learned a lot. Yeah. I took piano lessons when I was a little kid, up through 8th grade, and I sure wish I would have continued. But we're so lucky to have so many talented and experienced individuals out here, you know, and also with the help of Black Hills State, and also, you know, the School of Mines and Technology, and all of these touring musicians, the South Dakota Arts Council, they've all been influential in our decision.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about getting buy-in from the regular citizen who sees the price tag and thinks, you know, doesn't quite understand all those nuances?
Yeah, that's a really good thing to mention. When you talk about the length of life of something like that, it is a big price tag, you know, a $65,000 asset to your theater. If you've ever worked with an out-of-country musician who is traveling all the way to your town to play an instrument, and they get there and they realize that the instrument, which is their tool mm-hmm. for their music, is not up to speed, is not up to par, that's a hard thing to deal with. And that's what we've dealt with for the last 2 or 3 years, ever since the other piano, which at that time needed upgrades. you know, if you want to do things professionally and the right way, you have to have the right tools.
And that community will talk to each other and let each other know what your instrument is like as well.
That's right. We're already able to talk about our acoustics, and we have performers who come back for that reason. And there's a sweet spot in the theater that people fight over the seats, of course. But what's neat is that the piano itself is a draw, you know, and we also are in partnership with the Leeds Deadwood Arts Council. They have piano lessons, and the Sturgis Center for the Arts brings in those students here as well. And so this is just another step in the right direction for both education, for entertainment, for performing arts and cultural opportunities, and for our stage renovation. It's all hand in hand.
All part of the process. Tell me how you're going to celebrate the installation of this Yamaha Grand Piano.
Well, I hope that you're able to attend. It's coming up very shortly here. It's Saturday, January 16th, an afternoon concert, and that involves five performers and more. This is the first concert we'll have with this instrument on our stage, and it is truly a celebration. All of the donors, there's about 50 donors who have given to this, including the Lead High School class of 1964 and a couple of our past piano performers, Nina McIntyre, Paul Vandevelde, Dean Peterson, and Ruth Grenevelde, are local, and also Nina's from Texas. They're all part of this, although they won't be able to attend, some of them. It is January 16th, Saturday at 2 p.m., and we're going to show the acoustics, we're going to show the sound, and it's going to be a really neat event.
I'm guessing the installation itself is closed to the public. Are you going to photograph that and share what that process is like? That can't be any small feat.
You are right. Such an instrument coming in through the doors in itself is a media attention event, and so we have invited our donors. The public is invited to attend if they'd like. We are going to have a mini performance. And what is also special about tomorrow is we have our matching donor and his some of his family members to attend as well. And we'll have the media there. And what's also special about tomorrow is it's almost as exciting as having a piece of the theater restored.
And what comes next for the theater itself after this rather large project wraps up? What are you looking forward to?
We're already looking forward to the grand opening of the Interpretive Center. And when you say that, you think, what is it interpreting? Well, it's interpreting the entire history of the Homestake Opera House from the first brick to present day and in the future. And it is a tool for fundraising. It's a tool for people to understand about the history, this 100-year-old history of a theater built by a gold mine, and that's in the second floor of the building. It's a 2,000-square-foot huge exhibit of the entire history of this place. So it's kind of like getting a tour, but being able to come into the space and see tangible items, large-format photography, and all of this is happening while we are starting a capital campaign soon for the renovation of the stage and then the theater.
So how significant is this renovation and this facility to the city of Lead and the people there?
How important is it?
Yeah.
I'll tell you...
How key is it to your identity as a community?
Homestake, this is a company town long, long ago. Homestake built a gold mine. Homestake built this theater for the citizens of Lead and their mining employees as incentive to come to Lead and work as a reward for their hard work. You know, this was the hit of the Black Hills, the Opera House and Recreation Center. Imagine in 1914 a heated indoor swimming pool under a theater, and there's bowling alley and a billiard hall, and I mean, that was unheard of, and what a reward, what a treasure to have in this town. And it continues. It continues on. We had 81 performances in 2015, 81, which is that's a record for us. And alongside that, we had 7 weddings, 29 bus tours every Monday, May through September. I mean, we have 500 kids that come through for the Lead Field Trip Program with all the other organizations and attractions that we work with. It is thriving. It's growing. It's a story that I hope that people who are hearing this make it a point when they're in the Black Hills to come and stop by, and we'll take you through and show you this. It's an amazing story.
And I was there at the South Dakota Festival of the Books this last year in Deadwood and Lead, and it was glittering that night.
It sure was, yes, and it's really neat to bring in new people, especially that have to do with the humanities. Arts and culture and creativity go hand in hand. And
Sarah Carlson, thank you so much for joining us today.
New numbers from Sioux Falls officials show 2015 now holds the record for building values. City officials say the year ended with $667 million worth of construction projects around Sioux Falls. Those span from public-private projects to commercial buildings and different housing options. As SDPB's Keely Boltina reports, leaders say people are building housing and commercial projects all over the city, and the growth isn't concentrated in one area.
Sioux Falls issued nearly 3,000 fewer building permits in 2015 than the year before, but the value of those projects is higher than any other time. Leaders say the record in 2014 includes thousands of permits to replace roofs damaged by hail, but this year, major commercial and residential projects are more valuable. 2015 shows building permits for single-family homes and townhouses up. Mike Cooper is the director of planning and building services. He says empty nesters and young people fuel the demand.
Some of the younger population are choosing not to buy a house or live in a house right away. They probably will at some future date, but to begin with, they're looking at different areas of the city that have apartments with amenities. They like to be close to parks. They like to be close to shopping, to the bike trail, those kind of things.
Cooper says townhomes are sometimes affordable housing options. Mayor Mike Huther says people are still coping with the effects of the housing crisis, so that contributes to interest in multifamily housing. Apartment permit numbers are down from 2014. Last year, the city approved 804 units. Leaders say they are set to approve another 600 units already this spring. In commercial construction, Chief Building Services official Ron Bell says the city granted 24 more plans in 2015 than the year before.
For those 89 new commercial buildings, it was just about $179 million, and that was driven by Sanford Imaginetics, Republic National Distributing, Walmart, two schools, about $10 million apiece.
Bell says commercial addition and remodeling permits total another $170 million. He says developers expect more commercial projects from Avera Health and retail developers.
South Dakota is one of a few states that has no cap on the interest rate payday loan companies can charge. Some loan companies require an APR of 500% or higher. November voters will consider two competing regulations on payday loan companies. But only one proposal includes an actual cap on interest rates if the loan is in writing. SDPB's Charles Michael Ray has more.
The group South Dakotans for Fair Lending is proposing what they call an 18% cap on payday loan interest rates. Lisa Furlong with the group did not respond to multiple requests for a taped interview, but in an email she claims that the effort is far more stringent than that of other measures being proposed. But for opponents, there is a glaring loophole in the 18% cap proposal that they say intends to trick voters. The first sentence of the proposed amendment reads, "No lender may charge interest for the loan or use of money in excess of 18% per annum unless the borrower agrees to another rate in writing."
That is a red flag, and that allows the loophole, if we do pass the 18%, to allow them to charge more than 18%.
Terry Mills is with the group Consumer Credit Counseling of the Black Hills. His organization works to increase financial literacy and help consumers overcome money problems. Mills is critical of payday lenders.
They target poor people, people with bad credit, no credit, you know, a lot of options and things like that. So anything that could help those people save more of their own money when they actually have to use these places, they'd be much better off.
The Attorney General's own explanation of the proposed 18% cap on interest rates points out that it is a constitutional amendment that would eliminate other efforts. That includes the 36% cap voters also consider in November. The 36% statutory cap on interest rates is backed by the group South Dakotans for Responsible Lending. Eric Nelson with the AARP of South Dakota calls the 36% cap the true effort to stop predatory lending.
It will drive the industry out of South Dakota. It will make our friends and neighbors more safe from this toxic industry, and will make our state better overall.
Voters decide on the two proposals in November.
Lawmakers from districts in and around Sioux Falls are previewing their priorities for the 2016 legislative session. Wednesday morning, a couple hundred people attended an annual breakfast from the Sioux Falls Chamber of Commerce to hear what lawmakers anticipate in the coming weeks. SDPB's Keely Boltina has more on what was discussed by state lawmakers this week.
Lawmakers from 10 districts in southeastern South Dakota say they're working on legislation from work comp law to initiated measure changes to Medicaid expansion. Yet by far, legislators are focusing their work on education issues. They talk teacher pay, fair school funding, and even the basic way the state's education system functions. Roxy Loftusness is president of Availability Employment Services. She says she appreciates that lawmakers are concentrating on education.
Oh, in staffing, it's absolutely a necessity to have the quality teachers to bring the education forth, recognize the needs that we need in our state, and to retain the talent that we have growing up in our state, and that they have the tools and the trades, you know, not just the four-year degrees that people go on to achieve through education, but also those trades that are important to us, maintaining the infrastructure of our communities and our cities, too.
Technical education is a critical piece of that, according to State Representative Larry Zickmund. He says exposing students to tech skills in high school and middle school benefits students and South Dakota's economy.
As I talked to principals were saying, let's not forget the 7th and 8th grade program. Quite a few of them would like to get back to that, but they need some funding available to them and support available to them. So we need to look at getting back to rebuilding the complete system in vocational technical education at that 7th through 12th grade level to provide a good workforce for our people.
Education is likely to take a focus Tuesday as the session begins with Governor Dennis Dugard's State of the State address. He's slated to announce his plan for funding education following a massive effort from lawmakers, schools, and stakeholders in last year's Blue Ribbon Task Force.
SDPB will also televise Governor Dugard's State of the State address on Tuesday from Pier. It'll also be on radio, and you can also watch it live online as well. Just visit us at sdpb.org. And that's going to do it for another edition of Dakota Digest. If you want to view more programming from South Dakota Public Broadcasting or to view more radio news stories, just visit us online at sdpb.org. Be sure to connect with us on social media as well by liking South Dakota Public Broadcasting on Facebook and by following at SDPB News and at SODACPB on Twitter. Be sure to keep in touch with SDPB as well as we approach the legislative session this coming week. I'm Nate Weck with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Have a great day, everyone.